Hey, basketball fans, I'm George Sedano on the latest NBA Lockdown podcast. ESPN basketball insider Jeff Goodman stops by to break down the draft with me and talk a little trades, too. Subscribe to the podcast in the Listen tab at ESPN.
Now, ESPNW's The Trifecta with Spain, Jane, and Kate.
So, I want to start, ladies, after a big week of basketball with the NBA draft and all sorts of free agency news circling around with the big Kevin Durant news. The Warriors, the Spurs, and Thunder are the first three known teams that have secured face-to-face meetings with Durant starting next weekend, and there are a lot of other teams very interested in talking to him. A lot of this conversation comes down to money and knowing that the Oklahoma City Thunder can pay him the most, somewhere in the realm of $227 million over the next six seasons. Or if he wants to sign a one-year deal with the team option, second season, do a two-year thing there, opt out and maximize even more money based on new TV deals and the way his contracts work. So, guys, Kevin Durant will be the big topic this offseason. Do you have a strong opinion on what should be next for Kevin Durant? Kate?
Well, Sarah, I think if we leave the details of the money aside, because historically we've seen most NBA players realize that because of the Larry Bird rights, they're going to maximize the money, and often that means staying with the team that either has them, drafted them, assigned them, because they can make so much more. But if we leave kind of those details aside, because Kevin Durant himself has said he's not going to make this decision about money, it's going to be a basketball decision, which I think translates to where he has the best chance to win a title and where he feels like he will fit in the best. So when you look at it that way, and if it is determined by a title, you also have to ask yourself, where can he go where a title will mean the same? Because all titles are not created equal, considering we just saw LeBron James win a title that I think most people believe is worth more than his combined two Miami Heat titles. So keeping that in mind, it feels like, to just an average NBA fan, if you saw him win a title with Oklahoma City, well, then you would ascribe more value to that title, possibly. But then you have the caveat of the fact that he wasn't born and raised in the same state of Cleveland the way LeBron was. So there isn't that same emotional tie. So I'm kind of left in this place where I think it would be fine when I look around and I see Golden State and San Antonio. I think very soon after, if he signed with one of those teams, we would forget about the loyalty that you need to have because you were drafted by this team. So I think that when I got over that, I would love to see him play with the Golden State Warriors. I would love to see him become kind of the 1A option with Steph Curry right after that, and then Klay Thompson, and have this new age super team. I think very quickly, as NBA fans, we'd realize how exciting that would be.
Yeah, and I go back to what you said, Kate, about the markets, right? Like, because I think there was a time when we would have looked at Oklahoma City and said, not a big NBA market, not a traditional, you know, it certainly wasn't when they, you know, when he was drafted in 2007, he played his first year with the Supersonics.
Didn't exist, yeah.
Definitely
wasn't an NBA market then.
So you look at a place like that and you think, okay, so if you're going to get your next contract with your next team, maybe you would pick a team in a bigger market so that you could get more visibility. But I don't know that that's necessarily true anymore, because it seems like the rules on that have changed a little bit with social media and with the ubiquitousness of coverage, right? You're no longer only covered by your local teams. It no longer only matters, like, the visibility in your local market. So that, I think, is taken
Absolutely.
Away a little
and
bit
even,
for him.
And even Durant said that the other day in his conversations. He said, you know, this is about basketball. This is about who I'm going to play with and where I'm going to play, et cetera, and so forth. And mentioned, you know, I've gotten all this stuff here in Oklahoma City, my own shoe deal, massive amounts of endorsement money. And you're right, it used to be that players felt like they needed to go to the New Yorks and the LAs to get that. The world is smaller now. The NBA world is smaller.
It's interesting, Sarah, also that today on 98.7, Ian Begley, who is our own ESPN's Ian Begley, was on with Dave Rothenberg. And Dave, of course, was asking about the Knicks and whether or not KD would come to the Knicks. And Ian said that there was interest on Durant's part, but not necessarily on the Knicks' part, which I thought was interesting.
What?
I don't believe that for a second.
I'm just telling you what the expert said. The insider.
I'm sorry. We like old, washed up players.
Yeah.
We don't like players in the prime of their career who are basically injury free. But that's, I guess, a later discussion, Sarah.
Yes. Yeah,
save that fire.
We'll get to that later. Doesn't make any sense to me at all. That's very interesting.
It seems like he has no shortage of suitors, though, Sarah. So it's not like Durant has to be worried about that.
About Kevin Durant, and this is a conversation that's been going on throughout the playoffs and for years now, is why we treat Kevin Durant one way and LeBron James, for instance, another way, right? And Kevin Durant and actually many members of the Thunder haven't been that helpful with the media, haven't really wanted to engage, and yet we still, I think, ascribe to him the qualities that we felt about him when he first came out. This very sort of friendly, soft-spoken, easygoing guy, the guy who didn't do the decision, just did a very, you know, flat, plain, easy, I'm going to re-sign with Oklahoma City, you know, thanks so much kind of conference. And he's changed a bit. And I'd be interested to see if he did decide to go the sort of super team route of going to the Warriors, whether he would get criticized for wanting to go to a team that's pretty much set up to win versus sticking with his own team that's gotten very, very close, but hasn't been able to finish the deal.
Well, Sarah, where do you, like, as an NBA aficionado and fan, where do you believe KD should end up?
Well, I completely agree with you that it would be super fun to watch him with the Warriors, right? Just imagining Curry and Thompson and Durant and Draymond Green and all those guys on the same team would be amazing. But for me, beyond the money, OKC, listen, they had a 3-1 lead on the Warriors that they let slip. They were one win away from the NBA Finals and a really good shot at trying to take on the Cavs and win it all. And the Serge Ibaka deal that just went down, as much as Serge Ibaka was a huge part of the Thunder team for many years, the two veterans that they got back in OKC in exchange in that deal both have a better player efficiency rating than Ibaka. Oladipo's a guy that the Thunder were trying to move up in the draft to get. I would be very excited if it happens to see Durant and Oladipo together. I think that they made the team better with that draft move, that trade. And if you're Kevin Durant and you're looking at the Thunder and you say, look, we already were so close, I can go back and still be with Westbrook and still be on a team that was that close, and it's already gotten better. And so for me, I think at least for the sake of the short-term deal, which I think he's going to do that 2-year deal with the player opt out in the second year and stick with Oklahoma City at least for one more year.
Yeah, I think it seems like that's kind of what is the most likely thing to happen, because Durant has the one more year with Russell Westbrook, who's under contract for this last year with Oklahoma City Thunder, and then they both could hit free agency together, and maybe Durant then would have more information about what the Oklahoma City Thunder team would look like long term, because it seems impossible at this point that he would sign long term with Oklahoma City, given that he doesn't quite know yet, I'm assuming, what Russell Westbrook is going to do after next year. And he doesn't seem that Kevin Durant would think it would be the best basketball decision to stay in Oklahoma City if you think Russell Westbrook after next year is going to be gone. And I think we also have to point out that the fact that Golden State lost in the finals, and the fact that the Spurs, that Oklahoma City Thunder eliminated the Spurs, in a lot of ways has made it probably more appealing to Kevin Durant
Absolutely.
To end up in Golden State.
Absolutely.
Because one Sarah, go ahead.
I was going to say Mark Stein, our own ESPN NBA insider, talked about why Golden State's pitch is a better one now.
There is a feeling that their chances have been enhanced because they actually lost in the NBA Finals. Now you can say to Durant, you're the missing piece to get us back to the top of the mountain.
Absolutely. And if you're a guy like Durant, you know, we don't know exactly how much ego and desire to make sure that he's viewed as the one exists for him. But it certainly does feel like it's a much stronger pitch than, hey, we already won. Do you want to come and jump on the bandwagon?
And I don't know, Sarah, that people necessarily begrudge a player for making that choice. Sure, LeBron got laughed at a lot, but there have been a lot of other players who left as their careers were kind of in full bloom and won a championship with where they went to, and that's not been a bad thing. Like Marshall Faulk did that, or Randy Moss, another, you know, there have been a ton of players who've done that. And I don't think people begrudge those titles to those players anymore.
Well, Jane, I think what ends up happening is that we feel as fans very differently when someone is a free agent and orchestrates their own leaving for another team versus being traded, even though very often there has been some orchestration behind the scenes to trade a player to a different team. Like, you know, Sarah, we were talking before about Kevin Garnett leaving Minnesota and going to Boston. Now, that was a trade, even though in essence it was a kind of deal that was made that was almost like a signing because it was orchestrated. But yet, as fans, I think when we think Kevin Durant is going to willfully, voluntarily go somewhere else versus be traded, we have very different reactions to those things.
This is ESPNW's The Trifecta with Spain, Jane, and Kate, brought to you by Barbasol. Have you splashed in the Pacific Ocean and felt the rush? Barbasol has it, America, and Pacific Rush Shaving Cream. Barbasol, Pacific Rush. Kate, I think one interesting note about that is that in sports, for whatever reason, unlike almost anything else in life, we side with the man, and the man mm-hmm. is the team.
Right.
In almost any other instance, we want the individual to have the power and the control, and yet when it comes to sports, there's something about athletes being the ones in charge of the puppet strings that fans don't like. And it's a phenomenon that I think we're still unpacking, but it very much was evidenced by LeBron James and accusations of collusion with the Dream Team and planning in advance that he and Bosh and Wade were going to go to Miami. Miami got down to one player on the roster in anticipation of that year's signings. There is something to be said for whatever reason, fans deciding that they would rather have the power rest with the owners and the team than the players themselves. It's a loyalty expectation, I think, that we have for players that we would never expect for anyone else in life to have when their best interest might be elsewhere.
ESPNW's The Trifecta.
And what I was talking about, Kate, I know you had some thoughts on that, too. This idea that for whatever reason in sports, we tend to side with the owners and the teams and expect a loyalty out of players that we may not expect from ourselves in our own jobs, from anybody else in any other profession. If there's a better opportunity, more money, more playing time, all that elsewhere, we begrudge people for making a decision that might be right for them because of our loyalty to our own team. And we've seen that a lot with LeBron James, I think, and the power and control he has over the league right now.
Yes, Sarah, I think when we touched on this, I believe it was last week in discussing the Von Miller deal in the NFL. And I was saying how the fact that salary numbers are released for players in the NFL and the NBA seems to be the best thing that's ever happened to owners because average fans can't wrap their minds around why Kevin Durant would leave somewhere when he's already making upwards of $25 million a year. It's like once you know those numbers for the average fan, you kind of lose any sort of sympathy, empathy you may have with a professional ball player. And I think all of us grew up sports fans, and you somehow come to the belief at a very young age, even though it's naive and wrong, that the players on the team wearing the jersey of the team that you love have the same type of loyalty that you grow to feel for your team. And you don't learn and absorb the business side of it at such a young age. And so it's hard as you grow older to realize that a team isn't really a family at all. It is a corporation and a business and a job. And when you combine those two things, this feeling of like loyalty you have for your team, combined with the fact that the money is so astronomical that it's hard to relate to the player, and we're left with this space where we don't very often side with the player, despite the fact that the player is making a fraction often of the money that the owner is making. But we never see that.
Well, right, yeah. Kate, and so often the financials for teams are cloaked. You have no idea how much they're pulling in, how much they're paying in expenses, what their net is, any of that. You have no way of knowing. And the other thing is, like, most of those owners are fairly anonymous outside of a certain circle, right? Like, I mean, outside of Cleveland, you know, how many people could pick Dan Gilbert out of a lineup before last week, you know, and he was all over TV sets? I mean, I think that the personal attachment that you have to a player is so much stronger than the personal feeling that you might have for the guy who holds the piggy bank.
Yeah, and there's an expectation too that, like, oh well, they get to play a game for a living. Look at all the money they're making. I would do that for free. And people don't feel the same way about some corporation or some owner who, you know, made money in some other business and went out and bought some teams. It is interesting too. Like, we don't have websites. We have, you know, salary cap websites and websites that you can look up every single person's how much money they're making by the year, how much they're making in total, what's guaranteed. We don't have that for owners. So we think, oh, well, they make enough money. They're fine. Well, yeah, the person whose side you're on makes even more money. regardless of who the players are and whether their team wins or not a lot.
And Sarah, it's funny because like we do, like every movie made in the United States is all about the scrappy little guy going up against the, you know, the unwinnable situation and, you know, beating all the odds and everything. But when it comes to actual, when, you know, players and teams and sports, we're constantly going for the big guy.
Yeah. The example I always think of, it's obviously very specific to home, but the Chicago Cubs and the Rooftops had this deal in place, and it was a certain length, and they got a certain percentage of the money that the Rooftops made for fans buying packages to watch the games from above. So they weren't in the stadium, and so the Cubs got a percentage, and they allowed them to do their business. So then new owners come in and decide that they don't want the Rooftops to be able to do that anymore, and they want to basically buy them out or force them out, even though they have a contract. And all the fans are siding with the Cubs. And I'm thinking to myself, if this was like, let's say, Walmart, and they wanted to build more parking space, and they were going to kick a bunch of people out of their homes to build more parking spots, you would never side with Walmart, right? But when it's a sports team, you always side with them, even when they're in the wrong, even when they're the ones who are trying to avoid a contract. And we do this all the time. We're so loyal to our teams that we want what's best for them, regardless of whether we're able to admit that what they're doing is right or wrong.
This is ESPNW's The Trifecta with Spain, Jane, and Kate, presented by Progressive Insurance. More independent agents sell Progressive Insurance than any other brand. Find an agent at progressive.com. Now that's progressive. Right, Sarah, I read a quote this week from Hassan Whiteside of the Miami Heat where he said, "I'm a businessman who happens to play basketball." I don't think we view our athletes as that. We think only of playing on the playground and the joy that playing baseball in the sandlot brought us growing up. We don't always consider that for a lot of these guys, playing basketball isn't just some sort of like childhood joy, passion, although you hope that they reach that on occasion as they're pursuing it, but it's a business. And they see themselves as businessmen whose vocations happen to be athletics. And it's really hard for us to wrap our minds around that. And it's the same with, you know, going to see a Broadway play like Hamilton. You know, this is for you is pure joy and what you're doing in your spare time to distract you from your business. And it's hard to realize that for those people who you're watching, it is their business.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like Lamar Odom,
thank you for bringing
leaving.
Up Hamilton yet again. To remind me that I still have not seen it.
Wouldn't be a show without mentioning Hamilton,
without
Sarah.
You guys rubbing it in.
You got to see it by July 9th because that's when Lin-Manuel
trying.
Miranda
We've
leaves.
Been over this. I'm going to make it happen next Thursday, and I'm gonna spend all of my money, and it's going to be worth it.
All of the monies goes to
all
the Hamilton.
All of the monies will go to Hamilton.
ESPNW's The Trifecta.
Hey, I'm Chad Millman on the latest Behind the Bets podcast. Arash Markazi breaks down how he ended up at the club in Las Vegas with the Cavs after Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Subscribe to the podcast in the Listen tab of the ESPN app.
ESPNW's The Trifecta.
Derrick Rose headed to your Knicks, and he wrote a story for a website called The Cycle, which I had not heard of, but it exists. And he talks about how he was actually in the middle of an interview talking about Chicago when his phone was ringing and ringing. He finally picks it up and realizes he's getting traded. And in his introductory press conference and in this piece on The Cycle, he says he's ready for New York. He's looking forward to sort of a fresh start. He's thankful for the opportunity to kind of have a fresh beginning somewhere new. And he said he feels like he's going to be more appreciated in New York than he was in Chicago.
That's for sure.
Well, it's interesting because there's a pretty big divide in Chicago. There are a lot of people who still are incredibly loyal to Derrick Rose, hometown boy who made good out of a very dangerous and poor neighborhood and brought the city back to a level. You know, a lot of people they didn't win a title, so a lot of people kind of say that He was massively unfulfilling. But, you know, up until this season when they didn't make the postseason, they had the third longest streak for postseason appearances in the NBA. And we were undergoing such a Jordan hangover, and we still are here in Chicago, that there was a level of excitement and enthusiasm for the team and expectation that we really hadn't had in years until Derrick Rose sort of inexplicably beat the odds as far as the draft lottery goes and the Bulls were able to select him. For me, it's a very sad story that the narrative never panned out. You know, the prodigal son comes home and manages to take the team to the top. And it's very sad that a lot of it was just injuries and bad luck. But in the end, he did a lot of stuff that really turned people off. So there, as many loyal people that are sad to see him go, there are a lot of Chicagoans who are definitely ready to say, okay, this era is done. Time to move on. How do you feel getting him coming to your city, Jane? Is there an excitement there, an expectation that he will actually play all of the games in a season or even half?
Well, Sarah, let's look at it this way. He could come to New York and win two titles and then go back to Chicago
just
and win
like,
another title.
Just like LeBron, right?
That would work. I think that would work for everybody here. It's interesting because, I mean, as we all know, the Knicks are a team in the Dolan era that haven't seemed to get a lot right when it comes to bringing players in, veterans with big contracts. I was just looking at the point guards, some of the point guards that the Knicks have brought in. 2004, Stephon Marbury. 2006, Steve Francis. 2011, Chauncey Billups. Remember that?
Hey, Colorado boy.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, you gotta think that the Knicks are maybe this could be good for them, right? Like sometimes you have a job or you're working with people or you have a social group where things just aren't working for you anymore and it's not vibing with this group. And then you go move cities and you meet a new group of people and they're all your friends and everybody's excited. And you can kind of get your mojo back. And I feel like that's kind of where Derrick Rose is, where he is in a position where, like, the way that he fits in the floor could be good for him. He's, you know, he had a pretty healthy year last year compared to the 2 years prior to that. So, I mean, it seems like things could go well for him here. I'm optimistic.
Jane, Sarah, despite every rational fiber in my brain telling me that this is just more of the same from the New York Knicks, I am so excited about this deal. I don't know if I'm just deluding myself because I'm desperate as a former diehard Knicks fan who now just lives in New York. And because I'm in sports media, I'm not quite as diehard because that would just be wrong. But this is so exciting to me. And I'm going to first lay out all the reasons why the rational part of my brain understands that this is a ridiculous move that is just more of the same from the Knicks. Because basically since Latrell Sprewell, and we signed, and since the Knicks signed Allen Houston to that mega deal.
Awful deal.
And he also had the knee injuries. Like, we've seen nothing but the Knicks absolutely refuse to build through youth and the draft and just make deals exactly like this one. We've seen it for 15 years. So I should know better. I should know that Derrick Rose, despite only being 27 years of age, is going to come here and continue to be injured. And there's going to be a lack of chemistry between him and Carmelo Anthony. And they're going to sign Dwight Howard, who's going to come in and want 20 shots a game. And the Knicks will be 500. I should know that this is going to happen. But even though I know this is going to happen, there's a part of me that thinks Derrick Rose is only 27. What if he's right? What if he's been out in L.A. working on his health and his game, and he's going to come back in 2011 form and average 27, 8, and 6 for the New York Knicks? And not just that, but he's going to be able to recruit some free agents, and for the first time, New York's going to be a desirable location. Carmelo Anthony's going to have a renaissance because he finally realizes he's playing with guys that actually give him a chance. Porzingis continues to develop.
The unicorn.
And the Knicks can sign Joakim Noah, who's actually from SoHo, so might want to come back here and is friends with. Do you see, Sarah, how this is going to possibly play out?
I envy your enthusiasm. As someone who was a massive Derrick Rose fan and defended him at all costs all the time, eventually that fire to defend him and that passion wore off. It's interesting you mentioned that he'll start recruiting. He's never recruited, and he refuses to recruit, so that's not going to happen. Even when it would benefit his team and his city, he refused to make phone calls to any massive free agents to try to get them to come to Chicago. He said it should sell itself, so don't count on that. Then you talk about the expectation for his health, and again, I admire your enthusiasm. I'm jealous of it, but three knee surgeries and the reactions that you know, less so the bad luck of being injured, but the way he reacted to it. And a lot of it was really bad advising from Reggie Rose's brother and from people in his circle. But, you know, the comments he made, stuff like, you know, I don't want to work that hard because I want to be healthy at my son's graduation. It was like 18 years away. You know, I don't want to put myself in a bad position for later in life. These are not the things to tell a city that's already watched you miss, you know, hundreds of games and be unavailable and be completely unpredictable when you are available. So I hope, I guess, for your sake and for Rose's sake, that he has great success in New York. I just think it's very easy to pick out who in this conversation has already had to deal with years and years of this and who is just getting impression new and thinks that things will be different.
Sarah, I couldn't hear you. Your mic cut out for a couple minutes, so I'm just still wildly enthusiastic. But I think Jane heard you.
I did. I did. And what I want to say about that is that nobody in New York cares about that. Like, nobody in New York was really paying all that much attention to, like, every single time that he said that he wasn't going to play, that he needed a little bit more time to heal or whatever, or that, you know, as the playoffs were nearing and he didn't get back in the lineup and the Bulls struggled. I mean, like, that's not our baggage. So he can come here and people will, he's got a fresh slate with that because people weren't in the details of that as that was happening.
I will give you, Jane and Sarah, what is my ultimate irrational trump card about why this is going to work. Odds are for the New York Knicks, after all of these failed blockbuster deals to bring in aging veterans, all of those deals have failed or yielded underperforming superstars. So many of them that I think analytically and statistically, this one needs to work. That's my trump card.
I think the 538 folks would probably tell you that's not how things work.
Is that not how odds work, that they're not tied together?
Statistical probability that after making a bunch of terrible moves, the next terrible move will actually be a good one.
Is that not how that works?
I think
that's how I'm going to call the 538 folks.
Past failures are not predictive of future success.
Future successes. Yeah. I would say look at the Cleveland Browns quarterback situation, and I think if anybody's due, it would be them, and they're still waiting. So
I think we can all agree that Derrick Rose is going to have a renaissance.
Great
and the
move.
Knicks are going to be really relevant next year.
I think that's where we end.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah,
we
where
can
landed.
All agree that
excellent.
Yeah, MVP season awaits.
Welcome, welcome, Derek.
ESPNW's The Trifecta.
We're happy now to be joined by Miko Grimes, host of the iHeart Miko podcast, available on iTunes. She joins us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Thanks so much for joining us, Miko.
You're welcome.
So let's start out with the Ayesha Curry stuff. Your husband, Brent Grimes, formerly of the Dolphins, now with the Bucks. You know, you're well known for speaking your mind on social media and on the radio and in your podcast about a variety of things, from his teammates to the team owners to how he's playing. And when Ayesha Curry got really into the NBA Finals and spoke out and, you know, in a kind of heated, passionate moment, said she thought the league was rigged, she got a lot of blowback and a lot of people said she shouldn't be voicing her opinion. So what was your take? I know you gave her some advice on Twitter. What was your take on the whole Ayesha Curry mess?
Well, me personally, I feel like if every other human being on earth gets to have an opinion, why doesn't she? I mean, to be honest with you, we all have an opinion about stuff, and everyone uses social media to voice their opinion. So I felt like she's been wanting to say stuff. She wants to just be a regular person, and she chose a moment to be a regular person that people didn't accept it.
Yeah.
Miko,
like if she was saying stuff all season or for a while, by now they would have kind of like expected it and come to, you know, like me, when I say stuff, it's not a shock anymore because I've been saying stuff for a while. So her, it was her first time saying something. So I think that if she says something again, it won't be such a big deal.
Miko, we spoke earlier about how these expectations tend to fall on women. And the expectations that they be quiet or just supportive of a team. Do you think that there should be, and not just for women, but for men, significant others of professional athletes, should there be expectations of what they will say about their significant other's profession?
I think there should be an understanding between the two. For example, my husband doesn't have a problem with whatever I say. I feel like if Steph or whoever is fine with whatever that family member is saying or doing, if they're okay with them voicing their opinion or saying what they want to say, then it's not a problem. I think that if there's a problem with the athlete, then it doesn't need to happen because for whatever reason, it could be a situation where the player isn't very good, isn't very talented, maybe about to get cut. And I know personally a lot of things that maybe your significant other or your family member say can, you know, harm your career if you're not talented.
Miko,
talented.
You mentioned earlier that when it comes to Ayesha Curry, of course she's going to have an opinion and should be allowed to say stuff. Now, you can say stuff, and of course, at the same time, the stuff that you say then comes with a price tag. You
and I don't think it should. That's my opinion, but I understand.
Well, how, if you don't, whether or not you think it should is irrelevant to the fact that it often does. Now, how do you balance the cost of feeling the need to send out tweets, perhaps, you know, to reporters who you feel like their coverage hasn't been fair to your husband? How do you balance that versus what you may feel or know the cost of sending those tweets is?
Well, it's tough for me. I feel like I'm a special case. And the reason is because I was a professional athlete and I also was a reporter. So I study football. I know football. I know the plays he's in personally. And a lot of people don't understand that on the football field, you can't say who was wrong. You can't say it's a lot of situations where people don't know who's at fault. You cannot right now tell me who the best linebacker in the NFL is. Nobody really knows that. Kegley obviously is called the best, but there are so many other linebackers, and this is no shade to Kegley, but they're better than him. But because he was on a team that was almost undefeated and he played well in some big moments, he's getting shine. So I can see another wife saying, no, my husband is better than him. He's just on a worse team, you know, that he doesn't get the shine, that doesn't get the attention, all that kind of stuff. And so you're going to catch flack for it, but that doesn't mean the person is wrong. It just means nobody wants to hear your opinion.
Well, Miko, you mentioned that you have been an athlete, you have been a reporter. For somebody who has been a reporter to then, for example, as you did yesterday when it comes to the opinions Anita Marks shared on First Take, mm-hmm. to go after somebody with tweets that become filled with ad hominem attacks, how do mm-hmm. you justify those when you know you've been in the role of a reporter and understand what that job is?
I justify them by checking her, letting her know that you shouldn't say things that you first haven't done research on, and second, that aren't true. Is this Kate?
Yes, it's Kate.
Hey, Kate, yeah. You said some things about me, too, that weren't true, and you said some things about my husband. Also, you said that I needed a psych evaluation or something, that you questioned my sanity.
I did not. I did not question your sanity. I think Will and I had a discussion about you on Will and Kate, but...
No, this was on First Take. The day my husband signed his contract, he said, I question her sanity.
I don't think that happened. You'd have to find that, because I never said that.
I have it. You questioned my sanity, and you also said that my husband was no longer a number one corner. So, to me, as a reporter, I wouldn't say things that I don't have facts to. Otherwise, people will check you.
Is there a difference between checking somebody, checking a reporter and what they may say, and then also sending out threatening, attacking tweets? Is there a difference between those two in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely is.
We're talking to Miko Grimes, host of the iHeart Miko podcast, available on iTunes.
Yes.
She's with us on the Shell Penzoil Performance Line. Miko, I think what Kate is getting at and what's interesting to us is that, you know, as you said, you have been a reporter, you have a radio show, and, you know, you yourself said it's very difficult for people to come to a consensus on who the best player is or whether this person deserves this
right.
much money or whatever. So you may personally disagree with Kate or somebody else's take on whether your husband is the number one corner, but part of the job and part of how the industry works is to have opinions and to share your take on something. So there's a difference between tweeting out, I disagree, he's going to show everybody how great he is. And as you tweeted about one reporter, you know, he's not safe from bullets. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a line there. And I would question whether or not, you know, you wonder, have you ever crossed that line? Have you ever said something, for instance, what you said about Armando, and then said, look, I went too far there. Like, that's a threat to somebody.
No, I didn't go too far. You guys are misunderstanding what is called Black Twitter, which is slang on social media. You guys are the problem. The people that don't understand what other people are saying is the problem, because then you take what I said and make it this big thing like I threatened him. I didn't.
Well, you still call
so
the
how
slang,
you have
okay,
to
let's
take,
say safe from bullets is the slang way of saying, you know, avoiding criticism.
You.
But you also call them a fat B word, if you were a reporter, I would imagine you would understand that line of sort of civility and respect.
Well, the thing that what you guys don't understand is there was a lot of conversation way before that. In last summer during training camp, he and I got into a big verbal argument in person. In person, my husband was standing right there. My husband was very close to smacking him himself. He spoke to me very disrespectfully. But you guys don't know that. You don't know the underlying story of this entire situation. So, and also on Twitter, when he was he wrote all these articles, all these stories about me and my husband, all these things. And so someone else tweeted me and said, because once my husband signed his contract, and I was like, great, I'm done with Miami Media. I don't have to deal with any of them anymore. And someone tweeted me and said, you know, Armando is still going to take shots at you. You see that language? The language is Armando's still going to take shots at you. And I said, he's not safe from my bullets either. Does it make sense?
Migo, now there might be a bit of a backstory.
It has nothing to do with me actually shooting someone. Like, why would I even... You guys keep calling me stupid, and that's what really bothers me. I'm not stupid enough to actually threaten somebody on social media in that way. The only threat I will put to somebody is that I will whoop your ass if you ever come into my space and disrespect me. I would never threaten to shoot somebody. Like, that's why I didn't even talk about it, really, because it was very stupid to me that anybody even thought that I was threatening him. It made no sense to me.
Nico, we have certainly not called you stupid on this show.
It could have been a generic you there.
I think that would not be something that we would really go for. But just to ask about what the consequences might be, I know that Stephen Ross, who is the owner of the Dolphins, had said that the social media interaction got in the way of Brent's contract, and that was part of the reason that he's not there anymore. Is that true, or do you think that was a smokescreen, or are you concerned about that?
The minute we signed, the minute the Bucks were the final team that we chose, we actually, the funniest part is, you guys were on First Take about 10 o'clock in the morning talking about how Brent wasn't going to get a contract. And at 2 a.m., my husband does not negotiate his contract. I do. At 2 a.m., I was just finishing telling the Bucks, congratulations, you have Brent Grimes. And they said, we're going to announce it around noon tomorrow. But we knew at 2 a.m., I was up. He was asleep. I woke him up to say, hey, you're going to be a Buck. And he was just like, oh, wow, okay. How much money was it? And I told him, you got more than the Dolphins were originally giving you. And he was like, how did you do that? And I was like, don't worry about it. You're a Buck, $8.5 million, go back to bed. I popped the bottle of champagne and was celebrating. So the next day I get up, and I'm in the gym lifting weights, and my phone's blowing up, and people are saying that I'm on First Take, and you guys are having a whole conversation about me, saying that Brent's not going to get a contract. And in my mind, I'm like, he already has one. Like, why are these people saying it was so ridiculous? I had 17 teams calling for my husband, but apparently there was 3 GMs that wouldn't talk to him. Okay, cool. We got 17 that we're negotiating. That's why I don't listen to the media. When we signed with the Bucks, the Dolphins asked to match the offer. So was Nico really the problem? Why would you want to match it?
I think what's
important.
What
I mean? You guys don't know what's really happening. I'm writing a book, so this is going to be in my book, but you guys don't know what was really happening. It had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with my husband wanting to leave the Miami Dolphins and them not wanting him to leave. You guys don't know that, though. You're listening to what he's saying. That's why I was able to say whatever I wanted to say, because my husband wanted to leave.
It sounds like it could possibly be revisionist history by Ross. We'll see. I think it's key for you, Miko, to, you know, you use a sort of catch-all, you for all media. I think it's worthwhile to separate media members from each other, because, you know, it can get you in trouble to sort of take shots at everybody.
There's so many of them. There's so many media members that say things about me or my husband that are completely false. Completely far. Kate, when you said my husband was no longer number one corner, I wanted to ask you so many times how many Dolphin games you watched when you said that. I just wanted to ask you. I just wanted to know.
Miko, was the concern an opinion on the ranking of Brent Grimes terms of quarterback rankings or something else? Because as a former media member, it seems like you would understand that sports media talk is fueled by discussions like that. Now, if I said actually that you needed some sort of psychological... I would never have said that.
Okay.
There are clear lines there between... We could debate all day whether Brent Grimes is a number one cornerback or not, and certainly you have more insight into that, having certainly watched more Dolphin games since I live in New York. That would be a discussion that we could totally have. But the part where it then becomes ad hominem attacks like the ones that you sent to Anita Marks.
I didn't attack you.
No.
I didn't attack you. Honestly, I do respect you a lot. I respect you as a journalist. And I kind of respect you as a basketball player, too. So I have certain people.
Now you're
that
using flattery. It's just not fair.
No, I'm dead
serious.
We all
respect her there.
I've never disliked you, honestly. I've liked your story. I've liked everything about you. I'm not kidding. I don't blow smoke up people's, you know what.
Well, we appreciate you coming on the show to talk about all of this today, Miko.
Thank you. I know what you're saying, and you're saying that sometimes I attack people for their opinions when where it comes from, and I'm going to be honest with you, it comes from me being a reporter and saying things when I was on the radio and other, you know, aspects of my job, and other reporters attacking me saying, I don't know anything. I only got my job because of my husband. This happened to me so much in Miami. It never happened to me in Atlanta. I was in Atlanta for 7 years. No one ever attacked me for being Brent Grinder's wife. As soon as I came to Miami, all the reporters there attacked me. All of them, except Omar Kelly. He's one of the only people that embraced me and listened to me and didn't attack me. So I have been in attack mode for 3 years, and I'm happy to be out of it.
Yeah, you'll have a fresh start in Tampa Bay, and hopefully you'll establish yourself and your opinions, and we'll get whatever respect you deserve. Thank you so much for joining us, Miko.
Thank you.
Interesting conversation with Miko Grimes, and she made a couple salient points that I agree with. But a lot of what ends up happening in these conversations is this sort of, you know, these are the facts as I see them, and this is how everything went, right? So her explanation as to why the Dolphins owner claimed that she was a part of the reason they didn't re-sign him, and then she claims that they were, you know, actively pursuing him.
Right.
I think my main issue is, for someone who's a radio host and a reporter, or was at one time, I'm not sure which of those jobs she's currently still doing. I know she has a podcast. She said it herself, I have my own set of rules, right? Or I'm a different case. And I think you can't have an expectation for everybody speaking to know every detail of your life, your husband's contracts, et cetera, and react in a way that, if we don't have all the facts of what you're tweeting either, can be misread. So if you are aware that not everybody has the same facts you do, but then you put things out into the world via social media that can be easily misconstrued or can be easily considered disrespect to your husband's teammates or owners or whatever, that's problematic whether or not you believe it's your fault or not. It's still going to be viewed as problematic.
Right, Sarah. And I think when you mentioned salient points that Miko made, one that sticks out for me is that as a national media, you can't be the authority on every single transaction that's happening across the country. And yet there are times when something becomes paramount where you try and quickly become educated on it. And of course, Miko Grimes and Brent Grimes are going to have more information than the national media. And I think this is something that athletes have to come to terms with on a minute by minute basis once they're in the spotlight, is that when they hear their contracts and their interactions with teammates being discussed, there is a lot of authority within the media, the ones that cover it on a day-to-day basis, but there are going to be times where it's a game of telephone, right? And for somebody who has existed in the media, as Miko Grimes has, I wish there was a little more understanding of how that world plays out. But it's hard, right? I mean, she was on the line, and so therefore, I felt okay to challenge her on certain things. But now that she's not on the line, I don't want to just like jump up onto a soapbox and like explain anything to her, because, you know, I'd rather like go back and listen to the first take that she's talking about and make a decision about whether what she said holds any value or not. Because I certainly don't want to be somebody who's on any platform and making sweeping statements about anybody. You always want to make sure that you're offering some level of insight and nuance, because they're are human beings on the other end of every transaction and every word that you say.
Well, to me, Kate, one of the things that she said that really resonated was, I've been in attack mode for 3 years and I'm happy to be out of it. So I give her a lot of credit for coming on here and being, I think, honest, actually giving us some information. And at the same time, you know, I think it's important to point out that she has said things, you know, calling somebody a fat bee on Twitter. Certainly the things that she said recently about our colleague, Anita Marks, were unfair or below the belt. And so I think it's possible to see both of those things at the same time and to see her as a three-dimensional person. But it was interesting to get her side of it.
Well, and it's interesting to me, there is a hypocrisy to being frustrated with, say, Kate not thinking that her husband is a number one corner, but then also saying that we can all agree that no one really knows who the number one linebacker is and that everybody's opinion is different, right? So if you allow for the fact that so many of these things are opinion-based takes, then you have to be okay with people not always agreeing with you. And to take it to that next level of you know, for instance, with Anita saying that her opinion is wrong, so she's racist, or these, as you said, attacks, there's a level there that you're crossing.
That's true.
Sorry, I'm just processing all of this, Sarah. So you sent that out. And I actually had just Googled, is Brent Grimes a shutdown cornerback? Because that is something that you could then bring numbers to, right? And like have a discussion, which is what fuels sports media.
Scott Burnside, ESPN.com here on the latest edition of Hockey Today, the podcast. Craig Custance and I chat draft, expansion, all things NHL. We hear from Shea Weber and Connor McDavid. You can find it under the Listen tab on your ESPN app.
ESPNW's The Trifecta.
I know we get a lot of tweets because we've just solved the Olympic problem, and all of you are going to be showering us with praise for our brilliance. During the break, that brief couple minutes, we've solved everything. Kate, I nominate you as our elected official to lay out the plan.
Let me give you the first opening take, and then we can elevate it from there. I think we've all agreed, and most people listening probably at this point have understood how shackled each country is who has chosen to host the Olympics because of the infrastructure they have to provide, which then going forward often stands as ghost towns. I think we've all highlighted that over the last few years. So here's what we need to do. We need to assign the Olympics to four different countries. That's it. Every Olympics, they rotate between those four countries. And we make sure that they're spread across the world. So it's not just, you know, San Francisco, then New York. And we make sure that we're in locations where each part of the world feels somewhat represented. And then the infrastructure already exists. So it's not like you're building some huge monument that you're only going to use once. And the Olympics would become profitable again because there isn't a huge price tag that you're paying just to host the Olympics. All of that already exists, and certainly you're going to pay for security and to keep the trains running during the Olympics, but then there'll be the influx of tourism dollars that actually would make the Olympics profitable again, and we could avoid situations where they become unnecessarily dangerous. There's always going to be danger when you're hosting an international event, but they wouldn't be in a country that was in such flux like we're seeing in Rio now.
And also, Kate, if you had four spots, then in order to build the infrastructure initially, you wouldn't just rely on the host country. You could rely on the IOC could do the fundraising, or there could be a fundraising effort, but just one time.
Be cities that already have the entire infrastructure.
And you could bring in different events when the Olympics aren't going on, so that there could then be revenue generated by those events, and it's not just these white elephants sitting on the South African landscape that are deteriorating every year.
Because we often talk at length about the cost of hosting an Olympics, but within those Olympic years, there's the World University Games, and there are all of these other mid-Olympic year events that go and are hosted throughout the world, but they have a price tag too. It's certainly much, much smaller than the Olympics, but you could move those events also to these four locations.
And so,
Sarah, would you like to say something? Would you
yes.
like to get in here?
Obviously, what people will point out is that, you know, the Olympic Committee makes tons of money because of bribes and people that pay them to have it in their country. So will they be willing to give this up? Also, the idea of the culture and the excitement of bringing it to different cities. So we had a plan for that, which was that if, let's say, this year we assign it to Sweden. And Sweden, even though it's not on their turf, it sort of is like, what was your analogy, Jane?
If you have the U.S. Embassy in London, that's actually considered American territory, American ground in London. So you
right.
can have
so
it be like neutral.
So for the prep time and the length of the Olympics, Sweden would be in charge of the facilities and, you know, the opening and closing ceremonies and showing off their culture and their food and everything else. It's a bit of a stretch, but I do think that that's an element of the Olympics that's so great, and we're struggling to find ways to make the current system work, so we might have to think outside the box a little.
Right. It can't be perfect, Sarah, and everybody who's ever been on a budget realizes that you can't spend more money on something than you're going to be getting in, and yet every year people do that with the Olympics. Countries do it with the Olympics at great economic cost, and it's not fair to ask countries, particularly countries that may not have the resources to host things like this. You're not giving them, like, for example, with Rio this year, you're not putting them in a spot to shine when it's last minute, the water's disgusting, you don't know whether or not you're going to be able to have certain events in places where you thought you were going to. You're cutting the plan at the last minute to completely pare down things that are going to be available to athletes. The lab is having a problem. All of these different things. You need to be able to make it not so hectic and chaotic and last minute and setting people up for failure.
Rich, and we have some domestic examples of host cities that year after year have the same event. And it ends up breeding positive affiliations and feelings within those cities for that event. And I'm speaking of Oklahoma City hosting the World Series was for softball and Omaha for baseball. Those events come back year after year. So you've got the infrastructure and then that community starts to identify with that event in a new way than if it's just rotating through like the NCAA championship does sometimes to various cities and like the Olympics do to various countries. For that brief moment in time, that country assigns itself its cultural identity with the Olympics, but it's not necessarily like the Olympic city. And if you did have one city that always hosted the Olympics or various cities, like I think that you would breed a kind of social affiliation with it and there would be more pride in it, which I think we used to have for the Olympics.
We have a question on Twitter from Kevin B. He says, who gets to choose the four countries?
Well, we do.
This is the problem. Well, yeah, of course.
Well,
me,
right.
And Jane and Kate.
It would be unfair. It would be inherently unfair, but you'd want to spread it. You know, you'd want to have different continents represented.
But again, who chooses? And if it's the Olympic Committee, we're stuck in the same boat, which is basically
whoever can pay the most money.
Yeah.
Let's have Great Britain vote.
Yeah. And then there's the question of, you know, once you have these four places, does it, you know, assure you that it will breed great feelings of community and it will continue to build and be better every year? Or does it also possibly assure you that the corruption that is inherent with the Olympics will eat away at this community and will become more and more corrupt?
We're obviously avoiding the elephant in the room, which is that like the IOC, and you can include FIFA for another organization that sells tournament rights, allegedly. Like, we're ignoring that it will have to run through their jurisdiction, which will inherently taint it. So it's just like a utopia proposal here where you are stripping the IOC away so that we could have some sort of fair process. Now, once you insert them back in, you're like, you're kind of left in the same place you were before, which is you're going to have to then be led to who's bribing the most, who's paying the most, which is part of the issue with this to begin with.
Look, they could still get bribes over which coast country gets to be the host each year, you know? So they could still bribe away for things
still
like that.
Still line their pockets, Jane.
And it could be like, you could even get like the small Caribbean countries involved. Like anybody could host it. It doesn't have to be a place that actually has like...
Do you think people will be less likely to go because it's the same cities all the time and there's less, you know, impetus to try to discover new places and things?
Maybe. But here,
there
but
are
would you
some
have,
flaws with our plan. Guys.
There are maybe no. One or two. But here's the deal. Would you have, for example, would the Giants every year ask different municipalities around New Jersey and New York to build a stadium new each year so that for 1 year they would then host all the home games and then next year they'd tear that down? Some other town, you know, Montclair would then build the stadium and go. I mean, that's ridiculous. And that's basically what the Olympics is.
Right. Somebody tells us your plan is terrible. No one is going to put up with that. It's like having the Super Bowl in the same city every year.
Mute.
Somebody else says the Olympics should be in Statesboro, Georgia. That's my nomination.
I'm good with that.
I love Statesboro. Is there a good coffee shop there?
A great idea. Have them put it on an island and everyone pays to develop that island. We should make a man-made Olympic island. And
like
that's
that.
Where it always lives. That would be great.
And then, but then the cost to get everybody there, okay, well, we won't go that far.
ESPNW's The Trifecta.